Welcome, everybody, to Mormons on Mushrooms. Just a reminder that this is a storytelling podcast where we discuss alternative methods for healing from trauma and seeking a more fulfilling life. A lot of times on the podcast, we discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health top priority. Lastly, the opinions offered by our guests don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the hosts. Sit back, buckle up, and enjoy.
Like, I think we just wing it. It's like, have we ever done a different thing than just winging it? What are our other options? Did you want me to write out a, oh, hold on, guys. I'm just going to use AI real quick and tell you all what you should be saying. It'll be to you in a few minutes here.
Well, I was hoping we'd go off the script, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a dramatic reading. Welcome, Cody and Brandon. Thank you for joining us today in this, what we feel will be one of the all time illuminating, enlightening, and I can't think of another word to put into that list of conversations.
See, that's like why Mormons, you got to script NPR. That shit.
Did you say Mormons on NPR? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And let's hope we can live up to it. And
yeah. Trying to live up to that introduction, I think we've already surpassed it. Like, just with what we've said so far, the NPR crack was lived up to it. We made it. Yeah. So what are you two been up to? We got some exciting things in the hopper coming up, and I know we're kind of like ships in the night, where you guys have been, putting together some really good episodes, and then Mike and I try to put together some episodes, but here we all are together now, and you guys have some big shit, like some big news. Will you tell us a little bit about it?
We do. We've been working like crazy. Okay, for a year now, but especially since basically January 1st. And so we've kept people updated a bit on this. Our episodes are a bit sporadic of what we've done with Roughly Stoned, but that's largely because our focus has been this documentary. And the documentary is now complete in its 40-minute version form. And so it's called Entheomagus. You can look it up, Google it, Entheomagus. You write it like it sounds, and if you don't spell it right, it will probably suggest you get to the right place. And you could go to searstonedproductions.com, searstoned with a D, productions.com, mm-hmm. And you can check out the trailer. And so we have been going full on this documentary, and we have finished it. And what we're doing now is we've got a few screenings in Salt Lake the weekend of April 27th and 28th. That's a Saturday and Sunday. And then also on the 29th, we have a big screening at a movie theater called Broovies in downtown Salt Lake. So 27th and 28th are at Natural Law Apothecary, Marinda Bowen's place. And so it's going to be a cozy environment. We've got two tickets left. That's all that's left for it. And then at Broovies on Monday, we still got a good amount of tickets. So come, they're free. You can just download, just request some tickets. Your name will be put on a list, show up, and we'll let you in. Bring friends, tell them all about it. 40-minute documentary about the psychedelic origins of Mormonism. And so that has been our focus for the last year, especially over the last 4 months, fully dedicated to it, and lots of cool things happening. So come check it out.
You can get tickets through searstonedproductions.com.
Yep.
I'm loving both of those. The searstoned and then entheomagus. Is that how you pronounce it?
It's magus, whatever. Mm-hmm. Floats your boat. I think it's tomato, tomato kind of thing.
So explain that title.
So without giving any spoilers for the documentary, Entheomagus was a loosely coined term that I started using about Joseph, combining the words entheo and the magus, somebody who can like generate an experience of God. It's like a magician who is adept at creating religious visionary experiences, should we say. I think Joseph was.
Yeah. There's so many questions asked about this. And one, I've seen the documentary and it is so good. Like, I was riveted for, and then it ends. It's like, okay, that's like, I could have sat through like another, an hour or two of you guys talking about this subject because it's so fascinating. And I mean, people on the podcast know that I have this working theory that Mormons are descended from Druids. And so it kind of taps into my like.
It's a confirmation bias for you. Like it's
yeah, it's like all the proof I need. Yeah. Perfect. But let's talk about that for a minute, because, you know, we have a lot of, I think in our listenership, it skews more ex-Mormon and very conflicting feelings about Joseph Smith. And so let's talk about the man, the prophet, the guy for a bit.
Oh man. Look, I've been talking to Cody. We've known each other in person for 2.5 years now, but our relationship extends a bit beyond that too. And, if I had to say where Cody stands after having perhaps 100 discussions with him about this subject, I would have a hard time saying it. And I think he'd have a little bit more clear of a picture for me, but mine is evolving as well. And then the two other main people that are involved in this documentary, they too have different views of Joseph Smith. And these are people that have delved into this idea of Joseph Smith's use of psychedelics, the magical background of Joseph Smith. And you have very differing perspectives. I mean, I could speak for myself, and I think what I'd say today is different than what I'd say last week. But like Joseph Smith clearly stumbled onto some things. Now, how conscious was he of stumbling onto these things is another question. And can you consciously stumble onto things, or are they just thrown at you? Are they in your familial line? What is it? But Joseph Smith clearly had access to some knowledge. He had access to ritual. He had access to a familial line that had very interesting things going into it. And it just all culminated in him. And he becomes this guy that starts a church that used psychedelics. And he did some really cool things. He did some really not cool things. And we have a mixed history of him, like we do of ourselves. You know, he's another person just like us, but he just happened to be the culminating point for a whole lot of energy that just condensed into him and then exploded from there. And I mean, that's how I sum him up. I don't want to judge him either way, because sometimes I tend to put him on a pedestal. I think Cody might validate that I say that maybe a little bit too often, and I need to push him off, knock him off the pedestal a bit. But, you know, I'm coming to a point where it's just, he was a man that was born into history at a really interesting time and had a whole lot of energy surrounding him, and that energy still surrounds his name to this day. That's it.
Hmm. I'm interested to see what you think my opinion would be.
That's the question I was just going to ask, actually. Could we get Brandon, your guesses on Cody's take, and then Cody, could we get some confirmation or cross-examination?
Oh my goodness. Oh man. Okay. Cody can be pretty. Cody has a tendency to be pretty harsh on, not harsh, that's not the right word. That's not the right word. But he just, when I go on a little bit of a high note, is like, Joseph was special. Look at what he did. Even if he was doing bad things, he's a special guy. Like, he wouldn't accidentally do all these things. Come on, he was really trying, and we should give him some credit for that. We don't need to worship him or anything. Just give him some credit. And then Cody's like, he's just a person. He's just a person. He did this cool stuff. So I think what I said is actually more in line with what Cody generally says, which I think is a sign that we've worked a lot together and our minds are kind of merging on things as time goes on, because we're looking at having a lot of similar conversations with similar people, reading similar books. But we overlap a bit. But I think Cody tends to draw a lot of attention to the negative things that happened with Joseph and just says, keep this in mind. Okay. Remember, he did this too. This was really bad. You cannot justify it. There were racist things that happened. There were people that were taken advantage of. There was like non-consent that was happening. All of this stuff was happening. Beware, like, do not put him on a pedestal. So I think that's kind of what Cody would say.
And Cody, you've prepared a special musical number for us. Praise to the man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll have to go get my kazoo real quick. by the way, Brandon, I love your Brandon voice. There's a lot of interesting character work going on, but you doing your own voice was funny.
I noticed that too, actually. That's funny,
huh? I think maybe the word I would use would be cold and calculating in how I read Joseph Smith. I think especially since like I grew up LDS, so like everybody puts this guy on a pedestal, in some cases higher than maybe is healthy. And so I try to be as objective as I can reading him. And after having read so many versions of this, you kind of start to piece together, like everybody's got a bit of the truth, right? That's what they say. And you can kind of start to piece together this picture of who he actually was, in my opinion. And I see somebody who was raised in a family tradition steeped in magic and drugs. and we go into this in the documentary a bit. Alex has done a lot of great, Alex Criddle, one of the researchers involved, has done a lot of great presenting on how capable the Smith family were as brewers and like herbalists. Yeah. And I think so Joseph grew up in this environment, doing magic through his teens, likely doing drugs with magic because that was just an aspect of, you know, ceremonial occultism at the time. Not everybody used it, but some people did, just like Joseph used a seer stone. Not everybody was into seer stones, but, you know, magicians kind of found their way into their own ritual framework. So then when he creates Mormonism, I see a lot of Joseph's career as kind of tiptoeing between con artist and pious fraud, somebody who maybe believed or drank his own Kool-Aid a little bit and was a bit of a narcissist, and so maybe really did think he was the special boy, and the ends justify the means. And a lot of really horrible things happened to a lot of the early Mormons because of his decisions. And so I kind of try and keep that in mind, and I view him as a bit somewhere in between full-blown con artist and an actual pious fraud. That's my view.
Well, and it's interesting the way you describe that. I think it ties into, it almost supports the use of entheogens a little bit, because as we've been in this community in the last few years, you see how, I mean, I'm obviously a big advocate for the healing potential of psychedelics. But there's also this thing that if you're taking the visions and metaphorical, like, reality, when you tap into that metaphorical reality and see it as too concrete or absolute, you can get a lot. There's a lot of narcissistic tendencies or prophetic tendencies that tend to emerge from these spaces. And Doug, in our last episode, I love how you described Mormons as having like an absolutism kink. And that's one of the things I love about this documentary, because like when I was Mormon, like Joseph Smith, he was on the pedestal, right? He was the guy, and all the history I heard about in Mormonism was to support him as the prophet of this dispensation, to usher in the second coming and second to Jesus Christ and all that. And then you leave Mormonism or when you start learning about all this history and all the other side of Joseph Smith. And then it's like you go on the Exmo subreddit and it's all about how absolutely he was a pedophile and a villain and a con man and all that. And in between that, I mean, maybe it's just yes and to all of it. I don't know. He's just a very complicated figure. And I love being able to now revisit Mormon history from a lens of nuance of like, these are just humans living a human experience. And not this, that doesn't excuse at their actions, but it's just, You can at least relate to the humanness of all of it, which I've enjoyed. And I think your documentary really highlights that, which I love.
And I feel like despite the fact that we come down on the entheogen theory, all of the researchers do have different perspectives on Joseph. So we did try and make a fairly neutral presentation of this. And so I hope that comes across when people see it.
I mean, that is really the trick with this whole thing, is we shot this with a general idea of what the story was we were going to tell. We divided it up between the three main researchers, is that the questions for this person are going to cover this subject. The questions for this person will cover this one, and the questions for this person will cover this. They'll have some overlap, but these are the general topics we're going to discuss. We didn't know tonally what was going to happen when we started editing. And it kind of came out the way that it did. And I wouldn't say we consciously went in with this intent, but it naturally happened where in the end, it's a presentation of information that is not a condemnation. It is not in any way trying to judge Mormonism or Joseph Smith. It's just a presentation of this is how it happened. And we've shown it to, I don't know, there are probably about 30 people that have seen it so far. And I've tested it even with my oldest sister, who had six kids in my family. She is the possibly the most hardcore Mormon of everybody in the family. And she saw it. And I said, if you stop at some point where you can't take anymore, let me know where it is, at what minute and what second, because I want to know what your mindset was, because I don't want anybody shutting this off. And she made it through the whole thing. And then we've had extensive conversations about it. You know, I probably talked to her for like 5 or 7 hours just about the topic, the subject matter of the documentary, because it's not meant to be a condemnation to Mormonism. We're just opening a new avenue for saying this is one of the keys to revelation that Joseph Smith was introducing, that he was using to people. We're not saying this was the only method. This is just one of them. And hey, we live in a world now where this is more acceptable than it's been, at least since the war on drugs started. You know, it's available now almost to the masses, and you can have the same key that Joseph Smith had if you want to consider it. Here it is.
Yeah, I kind of love everyone's take on Joseph Smith. I'm kind of in that point where he probably would admit to being somewhere in between all of the things that so far we've all said, right? Like, I think the Joseph Smith story is fascinating because to me it's a reflection of how inaccessible the gods had become for the last at least 12 to 1600 years, right? I mean, there for the longest time there was kind of to some degree. I mean, obviously there were always priests and priestesses, and there were always those emissaries to speak for God, but it, you know, religious history and mythology is fraught with stories of individuals being like, well, if I'm going to get to the bottom of this, I've got to communicate with the gods. One of my favorite stories about one of the things that happened frequently to me when I was on my mission in Taiwan is we would get all serious about the Joseph Smith story. We'd get all like sacred about it, and our voices would go into hushed tones. And sometimes we'd sing like a little hymn about how lovely was the morning that, you know, it was Joseph's first uttered prayer, and then he saw Jesus and God. And then we'd be so serious in that we'd let that pregnant pause hang in the air, and we'd ask the person, like in broken Chinese, we'd be like, how important is it that Joseph Smith saw God and his son Jesus Christ? And almost without fail, Chinese people would be like, it's awesome. I totally believe that, and I'm glad he did. I have a cousin who actually, you know, we don't see Jesus too often around here, but I had a cousin that was praying in a temple, and they saw Jesus. It was an interesting, yeah. So what I'm trying to say is that I think the Joseph Smith story is a reflection of what that puritanical, like what people thought about their worthiness to have access to the gods. Now, Joseph himself could have believed his own bullshit, because he could have been like, geez, man, I'm tripping. I feel like I'm talking to God. Like, is this crazy or what? Like, you guys see what's going on here? This is so easy to understand. For me, I draw the line when he's like, okay, and also bring me all of your finest wives and sisters and daughters, and build up unto me a kingdom. I think that's where I, you know, have to draw that's where I draw my personal Joseph Smith line. is that the lamest, most niche line you could use on a podcast where four white guys are sitting around hooing about Joseph Smith, where I'm talking about where I draw my personal line for Joseph Smith? Yeah. We've come too far. Okay. Back it off. We've come too far. I'm not saying that line anymore in my life.
I think it's interesting. You said you like, in terms of Joseph's career, you kind of see an evolution of what he thought of as personal revelation or prophecy. You know, in the beginning it was like, yeah, everybody should do this. Everyone should do this. We should all give everyone access to this. and that gets out of hand real quick, and he is no longer in power. So he's like, well, okay, you can keep your personal revelation, but mine is the best.
Yeah, and then you're slowly communicated.
And then it just slowly morphs into where he's just giving revelation based on people arguing with him, where he's like, oh, hold on. Nope. God's speaking. Bluetooth moment. Hold on. Yep. Actually, no. So I'm right, because God, I'm the prophet. So it is a very human story, and there's so much nuance to this. I think that's a problem with presenting it, is everyone kind of thinks you're coming down on one thing definitively on Joseph, but it's like, you know, at certain points in his career, we can judge him differently based on what he's doing. And it definitely changed throughout his career, you know?
Well, and if anyone's ever been in an ayahuasca share circle afterwards, you can see how it's like, hey, I felt nothing. Well, I saw these purple creatures and they were doing these like weird things to my chakras and like lighting them all up. And you can see how if everyone's trying to come from that ceremony, taking what they saw, the visions they saw as like literal truth, how it can get messy really quickly. But I guess one of the questions I have, because, you know, you're talking about your sister, Brandon. So if let's say I am a believing Mormon and I watched the documentary and I'm curious about the potential of Joseph Smith using entheogens, I feel like you can still maintain your faith in that sense, you know, right? It's like whatever the tool was for him to commune with God, like it's a tool and you know, a modality, whether that's meditation or being sick, you know, from fever because, you know, his surgery when he was a child or when, you know, whatever it was, the access point to the unconscious or God or the divine is almost irrelevant. It's the, you're still getting the access point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel. That's what I've seen so far with people that have watched it. This is in no way to challenge your faith in Mormonism. It's not meant to be like open your eyes or anything like that. It's not it's not telling you to leave the faith or anything. It's just saying that this is a method, and just like you said, there are methods that we have in Mormonism that we're very comfortable talking about, whether it's, you know, ponder it in your heart, think on it, and then pray, and then sit in silence and wait for an answer. That's a method. You know, another method is to talk to somebody else about it. Another message is to read what other people in the past have written that and find yourself in it and see how these books of ancient wisdom can apply to your life. These are methods of understanding yourself. One other method that was used in early Mormonism, as we present in the documentary, is entheogens. And we just haven't lived in a time period where we've ever been able to openly talk about this. And now we are. And so here it is. Here's another method. And you as a Mormon, a believing Mormon, completely believe in whatever faction of Mormonism you want. Watch this movie and just be exposed to another method that can possibly even further confirm your faith. And if you can speak in your spiritual language in a way that doesn't destroy your identity, maybe it will make you question things. Maybe it will make you view things in a new way if you try entheogens. But we're just presenting something that we're showing you there's a whole lot of evidence that indicates that this is what they were doing, especially on a mass scale when they're having 500 plus people at the Kirtland Temple experiencing extreme spiritual manifestations, many of them actual visions. And there are dozens and dozens of reports of these in journals that there seems to be a method that was used here. A lot of indication in these mass visionary experiences that entheogens were used. It seems to be very clear within his family line that these were being used. Joseph Smith in his personal visions has a lot of symptoms that are similar to those that happen when you use entheogens. And so here it is. It's just another key to revelation in the same way that meditating, search, ponder, and praying is a method. So are entheogens.
Well, and I don't think understanding how a miracle works makes anything less miraculous. Like, mm-hmm. Despite my opinions of Joseph Smith as a person, I don't think, like, he was performing miracles. He was giving people visions. That's pretty miraculous. I make the analogy in my book that, like, we understand how, you know, heart surgery works. We regularly, like, kill people and bring them back from the dead every day. And like, it's just a matter of perspective. 100 years ago, that was witchcraft and necromancy. But like, it's just something we understand and we know mechanically how that works. And so again, like the methodology of the miracle does not make it any less miraculous. We're not trying to take anything away from that.
I want to like emphasize again, I mean, you know, we've been touching on it and Doug, you were mentioning it. I think there's a magic to Mormonism in the sense of you can commune with the divine. We were all taught that since youth. And that's, and you know, there are other, it's not unique to Mormonism, but I don't know if there's another monotheistic Christian faith that promotes that as much, that like search, ponder, and pray, get your own confirmation, get your own spiritual witness. So it teaches people from a very young age that you can commune with the divine, that angels are coming to visit the earth again, that, you know, you can have visions. Now, similarly to, you know, we were talking about with Joseph Smith, Cody, like, you know, the modern church, especially the modern church today, it's like, okay, yes, you can commune with God, but it has to be within this strict like hierarchy of what you can and can't receive. But it's still there. And I think that transfers into Mormons' use and ex-Mormons' use of entheogens afterwards, or expanded states of consciousness, whether that be through plant medicine or whether that be through breath work or meditation or mindfulness or whatever. I think Mormons take to it really well because we've had that. It's like a muscle that we've trained since youth that like, oh yeah, I can act. I know what feeling the spirit, quote unquote, feels like. And, you know, for me personally, when I feel that feeling, it's like, oh, I'm tapped into my intuition right now. There's something, I'm tuned into my body. There's a message coming to me, whether that be through the divine, whether it be through my sensations, my body, my instincts. But it's like, I know what that channel feels like. And I think that's fascinating. And I think that carries, so that's why I'm loving the documentary and the timing of it right now is a lot of Mormons are starting to explore psychedelics and expanded states of consciousness. And so I think the timing is perfect.
Okay. So here's something I don't want to reveal too much about this, even though it's not like big, super big news that I'm dropping right here, but just like confirming what you're saying about Mormons being open to this. I was talking to a friend the other day who's writing an article in a Mormon magazine. It's not made by the church, but it's made by active Mormons, and it's Mormon-based. When I say Mormon-based, I'm specifically talking about LDS. And it's just a lifestyle magazine with Mormon themes, and he proposed the idea of writing an article about psychedelic use in there and the modern scientific views and therapeutic views of psychedelics. And he got the subject approved, and he is in the process of writing a pro psychedelic based article in a Mormon lifestyle magazine. You know, so like we are in a new era. we are in a new era where people that are fully active Mormons are considering using psychedelics. And like you said, Mike, that Mormons have channels, you know, everybody on earth is exposed to different, you know, forms of intuition and instinct and all this. We have different words that, you know, when you're in an altered state of some form, be it flow or be it in the zone or instinct, like you said, Mormons have other things that they call, you know, feeling the spirit or getting confirmation or whatever it is. The still small voice. Yes. And so we have these things. Mormons are very in tune with it. And these are very powerful because despite all of your logic telling you otherwise that like, this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't add up. But I remember that experience that I had where I felt something really strong when I was 21 years old, when I was in Cambodia, you know, teaching these people in this, whatever it is, this location, I felt that. And I've dedicated my whole life to that feeling once. Like people have those within Mormonism and it like causes them to commit fully because of that experience at that one time. Now, I think there's definitely something to it. The Mormons, because there's so much emphasis on those feelings and those experiences, that when they leave Mormonism, they're searching for it. And entheogens is one of the things that they naturally go for because you can get in tune again on a whole nother level and have one of those experiences that is going to perhaps shape your life for an extended period of time if you want it to. And if you do the prep work, you have that experience and then do the integration work afterwards, that can change your life in a way that is puts the other experiences, you know, in comparison. I don't want to downplay the other experiences that people have because I think they're valid and all of that and for the individual, but entheogens are times 1,000 Okay? If you use them and you want to use them that way, they have that capability.
That's interesting that you say that, Brandon, because like, like in the last 2 weeks, I have had a person who is a stalwart Mormon who's close to me talk to me about how they want to, they've been reading about and they want to try using psilocybin. They want to try using magic mushrooms, they said. And I was, and my reaction, because I, there are certain people that I don't talk about this part of my life with, and he's one of them. I was just like, oh, wow, that's interesting. That sounds very cool. And his next question was, and maybe you'd be willing to do it with me and kind of act as my guide. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'd love to do that. What makes you think that I would do that? And he goes, Doug, you have on your forearm, you have a tattoo of a mushroom space alien abduct. You know, this is the tattoo here. Talking about, you know?
Maybe you're not as in the closet as you think you are, man.
I guess I'm not as well hidden as I thought I was.
You walk around town looking like that, Doug.
You're like, I'm like, what makes you think I've ever heard of mushrooms? They're like, there's a fucking UFO on your arm that's shaped like a mushroom, idiot.
I'd hate to say, look at how you're dressed, but
also, yeah, that's fair. Fair point. My point being that you're. I have like real life anecdotal evidence of what you're talking about, Brandon, that I think this is, I think a new wave of this kind of thing is happening, where I think that there's been an assumption that the war on drugs was that people like Ronald Reagan were sent from, you know, God and that kind of stuff. And that goes back into Ezra Taft Benson and his political viewpoints. And that goes into, some of the God, I'm kind of brain freezing on some of those other guys, but like it, suddenly I think that the a new wave of members of the church are like, oh, I don't know that that's forbidden, and in fact, perhaps I could try it and it would be encouraged, type of thing. I think is what's happening.
I think that this is really a tribute to how the discussion has been opened up in society at large, because this time going into it, you know, because it's tried, there are periods of time where, you know, psychedelic use has been more openly advocated for and used in society, and they've approached it different ways. But because this approach at this time was done more specifically for the medical benefits, for the therapeutic benefits, for the psychological and emotional benefits of it, because that door was open first, it's so easy to see that there is something here, and also to justify it in the minds of people that otherwise would be opposed to it, because it's not about tearing down the system, which was like largely what it was in the 60s. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, like, let's look at it for the benefits of the therapeutic use. And, you know, I just think there was a lot of wisdom exercised in opening the door to how it's now coming through.
I'm loving this. So I have a question, you know, Cody and Brandon, I mean, Cody, especially with your research and your book and, you know, everything you wrote, and then, you know, the podcast you guys have done on the, Roughly Stoned, series that we've, released on Mormons on Mushrooms. I'm just curious that during the process of making the documentary, and did anything come out that surprised you in like the interviews? And then like, also like when you were stitching it together, I don't know, did anything come out in the making of it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Brandon has his own stuff to talk about. I think the coolest part for me was getting all these weirdos together to film something and then hearing everybody talk about their experiences. Like that was the, Alex Criddle, one of the researchers, when we were like in between shoots, he was telling me how he visited the Smith family farmstead, and they found a giant patch of amanitas growing there, and like, where you're just like, we have to go do soil samples, like, what? Like, mind-blowing things that are just like, we know that's out there, we just need someone to throw money at that in a way that we could actually publish papers on it, like, and then that's a smoking gun, like, nobody would be able to argue with the fact that just footsteps away from their family home, there was mushrooms growing everywhere, kind of in the same area they were using to grow hops and stuff to brew beer with. Like, that was for example, for me at least.
I mean, one of the things for me that was amazing with the documentary, there were a lot of amazing things that happened. Like, one thing I want to say before really going into it is that for probably 3 to 5 months going up to the shooting of the documentary, Cody and I talked on the phone at least every weekday for half an hour to an hour planning this documentary out. And so we knew basically exactly what we were going to do almost minute by minute going into the shoot. We shot the documentary over 2 days. It was just one weekend. And we had a public symposium the night of the first shoot, after the first shoot day. And so we got, like, I don't know, probably 18 hours of footage in 2 days that we condensed to 40 minutes. We could make a full length documentary out of what we have. But what we need to do before we do that is get more voices in there. We only have 4 voices right now. So to have 90 minutes, we got to have probably 8 or 9 voices in there to do it justice. But there is enough content to do it right now. But so, like, it was crazy how much we were able to do in a small amount of time. But one of the reasons we were able to do a lot is this is something that Cody and I discussed vehemently until almost the day of the shoot, which was how many locations are we going to shoot at? And then we decided the Gilgal Gardens is where we're going to shoot most of our interviews. And I had never been there before. I had seen the Joseph Smith Sphinx before accidentally online somewhere. I don't remember where I came across it. But then we went to the gardens, and this place is amazing. Like, anybody that's in the Salt Lake area, if you're within 3 hours of Salt Lake, you should drive to the Gilgal Gardens. Okay. It's right near downtown Salt Lake, maybe 10 minutes away at most from, like, Temple Square. And you can walk through this garden that was made by this guy named Thomas Child, who was a Freemason and a Mormon in the early 1900s. I'm not exactly sure what years it was, but he just made these gardens, these sculptures that, if you have a psychedelic mindset, are very psychedelic. They're also very, very tied to Freemasonry. And there are all sorts of scriptures that are etched into stone, famous poems, famous quotes, and then also quotes from himself that are etched throughout the garden. It's just a mysterious place that you can kind of go around and find your own meaning. But one of the awesome things about during the documentary shoot was that Bryce Blankenagel, one of the key researchers that we interviewed for the documentary, who's also the host of Naked Mormonism and the Glass Box podcast, he took me around the garden and he gave me an interpretation of it, like took me from this point to this point to this point to this point, almost like an endowment ceremony. That's kind of what it was. It's like, let me take you to this room now. I'm going to take you to this room and I'm going to say some words to you and I'm going to point some things out to you and you can interpret these as you want, because I've been here before and this is how I've had it explained to me. And it was just really cool. And the way that he did it was reminiscent of a psychedelic journey. And so, but is also reminiscent of the Plan of Salvation. So it's a very layered garden. You can interpret it as you want, go through for your personal experience, or perhaps you'll go there and you'll have somebody that can point some things out to you that's been there before, but there's a whole lot to learn at the Gilgal Gardens.
Wow. I'll have to do that.
Yeah. I'm just like, I'm just thinking of the weirdness of Mormonism for a minute, but in the cool way, right? Like, you were talking about, you know, you have this prophet figure and his head is on a sphinx in this garden. And then, you know, thinking of all the Masonic imagery and the kind of esoteric aspect of Mormonism that I think's been glossed over, especially, you know, you're talking about, Doug, and, you know, the Benson McConkie era, probably starting with David O. McKay, like, really started to kind of, like, shift from that to more of a mainstream church. But, you know, even I wrote this paper for my PhD program, and in it, where I shared it with someone, and she was like suggesting that I really look into, there's several books written on Mormonism and ties to Gnosticism. And Gnosticism was like this occult Christian faith that it kind of rose, like, was in the underground of Christianity, but was more of like a holistic belief that, I mean, I'll have our time describing it, but definitely Mormons' belief that, like, you can commune with the divine, that we need to have a direct experience with the divine in order. We can't rely on the faith of another. We have to have that own direct Gnostic lived experience of the divine. And then also the Mormon belief that we are gods in embryo. I mean, that's all, these are all very Gnostic principles. And so I haven't, you know, I'm speaking too soon on this because I haven't looked at these sources yet, but I feel drawn to kind of start researching that and looking into it. And I don't know. I think it's going to be kind of interesting what, like, I think this documentary is the beginning of a lot of, well, Cody, your book, I would say, and then this documentary, and then it's like, it's beginning of a lot. I think there's going to generate a lot of interest in this area, and it's going to be very fascinating to see what is unearthed from all of it.
But what comes from this? Because I think this is just a new way to, again, it's not to condemn Mormonism. It's to show like the depth of Mormonism and how you can explode from there. You can go all sorts of different areas. And especially once you give yourself the right to truly seek personal revelation, you know, that's what it's about, is that like, what do you want to do with it now? Where do you want to go with it? What, you have all sorts of tools that you've been given throughout your life. Now you empower yourself. And like going back to the idea of, you know, more or less becoming a god, like you were just explaining within Gnosticism, is that even the word entheogen, you know, is awakening the god within. You know, that's basically what it means. And that's what psychedelics can do, is that you become your own shaman. You know, you awaken yourself. You awaken yourself to the divine, and you become your own prophet. And that's it. That's the thing. It's self-empowerment. And so that's the beauty of what I feel is the message that's happening within Mormonism. There has been, you know, a lot of, this is harsh. I really don't mean it as a condemnation, but I don't have the better word right now, but a lot of being chained down within Mormonism, or being held within a community that seemingly has a lot of good intentions, but in some ways can hold you back. And a lot of people feel uncomfortable with that. And then they step away and they want to point their finger at the church, that the church was bad and all this stuff. It's just like, it's kind of the nature of an organization that kind of gets a little bit too much power. It gets some figures that have maybe some bad intent, or, you know, things happen in their past that they're overly compensating for and make some bad decisions or whatever it is that affect people for generations. Okay, these things happen. But there are also some cool tools that survived through Mormonism, and we're showing you one of them right now. And you know what, Mormons, you have a lot of other tools. Let's amplify it now. Here's another one. Do it for yourself.
Oh, I love that.
I guess I have a question for you guys. Do you mind if I ask you one?
Yeah.
As two people who've been so like heavily involved with this community for so long, and your Mormon backgrounds, what would you guys say a healthy relationship with personal revelation would look like, or what does that look like for people that are like, yeah, you said words, but like, what does that actually mean? You know?
Yeah. That's a great question. That's been heavy on my mind a lot. Actually, Mike, you know, I talk about this all the time. It's like one of my foundation. It's becoming one of my like foundational, personal values, which is, I think a healthy relationship with personal revelation is, steeped in, or first and foremost, it has to have the effect of so what and who cares, on everyone else. If my personal revelation requires action from any other person, then I'm in an unhealthy relationship with the God within. My personal revelation is just that. It is, ways that I want to approach, my existence. It's about ways that I can maybe adjust or change. It's about actions I can certainly take. But as soon as anything I feel like I'm getting as far as downloads, or what source wants, or what God wants, or what the machine elves want, as soon as I start telling people how that affects them and how they need to change their behaviors, then I personally believe I have stepped over that line. That's for me, that's a key and very critical point of my current value system, is that I can get all the personal sort of like downloads and shit that I want as far as what I'm feeling I want to do, but it's got to be a who cares and so what to everybody else around me.
Preach. Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you.
Awesome answer.
In that school paper that I was talking about, where the person who read it suggested I look into Gnosticism, it was actually about Lehi's dream and kind of interpreting Lehi's dream from like a Jungian psychological lens. Like if an analyst came to me and, or an analysand came to me, a patient or whatever, came in like, presented this dream and we unpacked the metaphorical images, it almost turned Lehi's dream on its head in a way of like, here was Lehi having this experience of the divine, which he saw as the tree of life, and he's eating of this fruit. And I feel like I've had a lot of those experiences over the last few years where I've been like, you know, whether through a psychedelic trip or like after a Kundalini yoga breathwork session where I'm like, oh my gosh, I get this download and this inspiration. Even this podcast is evidence of that, right? Like I had it like an inspiration, let's start a podcast. And so I've also been guilty of like, hey guys, come partake of this fruit. And I shouldn't say guilty of that, because I think there is something, I think we should share. I think we should say, hey, I got this fruit, taste it, come taste it. Where we need to be careful of is then we say, this is the fruit, this is the way. And then when you set up that this is the way, now you set up this straight and narrow path, this iron rod, this mist of darkness, this false dichotomy, people in the great and spacious building mocking those who are clinging to this path, people who feel like they can't, there is no life outside of this path. Even if they don't feel inspired, I mean, even in that vision of the tree of life, people went and partook of the fruit and then fell away. And they didn't fall away because they were like, you know, if that really was amazing fruit to them, no one is falling away at that point. They tasted it and they're like, you know what? Okay, Lehi, I'm sure you like the taste of this fruit, but I didn't really like it. And and like all of a sudden I hear like this siren call in the mist of darkness. Like, okay, I'm going to check out other things, you know? And I think it's very important for us, as I think these type of experiences are going to be more common if psychedelics continue on the trend they're going. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that personal nature of the revelation, and that it's great to share, but it's your personal insight and metaphors and symbols and images.
Answers. Those are great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, completely. I think that, you know, this is such an exciting world to me, and I want everybody to know about it, but it's something that you definitely have to be informed about before you get in. And then once you're in it and you have your experiences, you need to have the right parameters set up to make sure that you're integrating your experience properly, mm-hmm. that you're holding it to yourself, that this is something for you, that this isn't the answer, the only answer, or anything like that. And then being cautious with how you talk about it with other people. I love it. I love what I've stumbled upon within earlier Mormonism. I think there is tons of potential here, but like there are a lot of ways to exercise caution in this. Fortunately, Cody and I also live in Oregon where you can legally use this. And so there are a lot of parameters set in place to use it safely as well, where you can use it with a professional to help you get the most out of your experience that you possibly can. And so it's an interesting time period, and it's something to use, you know, educate yourself as much as possible going into this, but there seems to be a whole lot of potential with it.
I'm pretty pumped about this, guys. I'm pretty pumped about the documentary and just see where it kind of goes from here. It'll be kind of cool. I got to wrap up a little bit. Do you guys want to all wrap up, or do you want me to just quietly dip out? The way I've said it negate me offering to quietly dip out?
I think we plugged the delicious fruit one more time. So you guys have some delicious fruit you're sharing. Let's plug it one more time. You plugged it at the beginning, but now people listen. They're more interested. They're curious. When are the screenings? How can they get tickets?
Yeah, the screenings are April 27th and 28th at Natural Law Apothecary in downtown Salt Lake City. They are free tickets. You can get them at SearStonedProductions.com, SearStoned with a D. And so just claim a ticket. We'll put you on a list and you can get in. There are two tickets left for that, so you got to go quick. But there's a bigger theater called Broovies that's just around the corner from Natural Law Apothecary. We're having another screening on Monday, and we just made those available about a week ago. And so we've got a few dozen of those left. So come claim tickets. We'd love to see you there. We will have a Q&A afterwards. Like the filmmakers will be there. So ask us all the questions that you want. We want to connect with people. We're looking at getting an agent right now. We're having some conversations to try to make this a bigger deal, because our dream is to make this a multi-part documentary series and turn it into a scripted series. So the Joseph Smith story from a magical and psychedelic point of view, but looking at his whole life or career as a prophet. So Entheomegas is the documentary. Entheomegas, SeerStoneProductions.com. Go get tickets. We'd love to see you there.
You guys are so fucking cool. Like, you guys are awesome.
It's good for our ego to come on. Thanks for having us. This was fun.
Thank you. That was awesome.
We should do this more often. I love coming on and chatting with you guys.
I do too. Yeah, this is a fun. This is a fun.
Now give it. Now, hey, Mike.
Yeah.
Let's actually come up with an identity. Like, what's the name of the identity that you're going to read this one as?
His name is Cool Joe.
Cool Joe, baby. Here it comes. Ladies and gentlemen.
The first name that came to me when you said that was Patrick, but I want to read it as Patrick.
Dude, I'll do it as Patrick. You do it as Cool Joe.
Okay.
You ready?
Maybe you start it and I'll do the
next part. All right, here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. As a reminder, the very best way to support this podcast is to just head on over to patreon.com/Mormons on Mushrooms.
There you're going to find bonus content, fun episodes, other shit.
Girl, we're talking about shit you have not heard before.
Never. Mankind has never heard these things before. So go on over to Patreon. But we'd also love it if you gave us a review. Just head over to Apple and give us a quick love over there. Quick love. Quickie.
Just a little bit of love on Apple. Listen, if you're listening on Spotify, that's cool too. Put up a 5-star if you liked it. If you didn't, keep your mouth shut.
Just maybe put up a Flavor Country.
We love Flavor Country. By the way, Mike and I also accept just free pure money, and you can do that at Venmo. Mike, hit him with the deets.
Just put them in our pocket. Just give us some money at Mushmore, M-U-S-H-M-O-R, on Venmo, and we'll use it to buy some kombuchas. Just have a good time.
M-U-S-H-M-O-R. What up? Peace.
Fucking yes.